Hi, everybody. This is Dean Hagler from the Offices of Rational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core of Los Angeles, California, in the middle of the Art Deco wonder known as the Eastern Columbia. And this is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. And coughing right beside me, my fabulous co-host, Mr. Phil Ernest, ladies and gentlemen.
It has been quite the workout these past couple weeks. I mean, we're finishing a movie.
Where I am.
Got press kits. You're shooting something coming up.
I am.
I mean, I'm prepping another project. I mean,
we've crazy.
Got so much going on.
So much.
And and I'm playing a little hurt. I'm not going to lie to you. But next week we'll talk about, because I've got a couple amusing anecdotes.
Oh,
about
I love the anecdotes.
Some injuries, some stupidity.
That you did?
On my part,
Can't wait to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, just stuff. You know, I'm not dealing well with this venturing into my, well into my 40s now. I'm not doing so good, not so graceful with this.
Are you saying it's not the new 30 after all?
40 was, but that was more than 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So anyway,
haven't got your gift.
We'll talk about that next week. I want to hear about the shoot that you're doing.
Yes.
The big LA premiere coming up of another movie that you did.
Crazy.
So next week, we have so much stuff to talk about and catch up on. We've had great emails from listeners
that we got to answer.
So, you know, so much has been piling up.
And what about school closures?
and of course, you know, we have we've got some big events coming up as well. So we've got that. I've also arranged a fantastic guest for us for the weeks coming up.
Really?
So we'll be revealing that.
First I've heard of it, too.
Later on.
I'm glad we have our production meetings on air like
well,
this.
Well, why don't we don't really see each other now except on air because we've both got so much to do.
It's true.
It's text messages and then a show every week.
Right.
I mean, truly, we had to go and sign off on the post-sound mix. And sign off on the post-sound mix.
Right.
And so what do? We record a podcast then.
Why not? Yeah exactly.
You got to like double up on these things.
It's true.
But all that is coming up because today...
Oh, my gosh.
...is an annual theme show.
A theme show where we sort of review the past year of movie viewing.
13 months in the making.
Though I didn't include anything from... Well, I watched...
Top 10 films of 2010, and my top 10 films of 2010, and it's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
See how that all came together? Yes, our review of the top 10 movies. Now, for me, this was very difficult, I might point out, much more difficult than other years. A, because I saw a lot of crap this year somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I joked about this, or did I joke? I don't even know if it was a joke. Let's tell a joke later so I can tell the difference.
Because I can't.
But I had suggested at one point that maybe I handle the top 10 and you handle the bottom 10.
Yeah, because that would have been smart. I could have handled that.
Yeah, that would have been kind of an interesting countdown.
It would be, because I've seen Night and Day with Tom Cruise. I've seen The Tourist.
You saw The Tourist, yeah.
I saw The Tourist. I saw Killer. Is it Killer?
Killers.
Killers with
Ashton Kutcher.
Yeah. Holy smokes. There was a movie that I could have shot with my home handycam, frankly.
I'm glad you didn't.
I should.
Because there would have been no excuse for you to be unavailable during that period.
Yeah.
So. By the way, you know a movie that looks really good?
What's that?
I mean, visually, like the texture and the color and the lighting and everything looks like a million damn bucks, or I guess that's not much in a budget. 10 million damn bucks?
Super.
The truth is out there.
Been
doing the color corrections, and I mean,
it suddenly looks like
a real
movie.
We got the best in the business working on it, and it looks really incredible.
Awesome!
Anyway, I'm very excited about that.
Can't wait.
So it's tough, and I guess we always start with our caveats this year because we always seem to get bogged down and then rush through the ones at the very top of our list.
Right,
like 3, 2, 1. We're running out of time. This year, as a preview. We got our honorable mentions out of the way
exactly.
In our blog over on MySpace.
Smart.
So for those of you who don't know, every week on MySpace, we preview
the
coming week show with a blog. And that's myspace.com/chillpackhollywood. You don't need to be a member of MySpace to read that blog. It's
right.
A public page. You can find the blog previewing each week's show. We always post it on the weekend. And this past weekend, just yesterday, as a matter of fact, we listed our honorable mention.
Yes.
Films that we certainly would recommend, but that didn't quite make our top 10 list.
Yeah.
So check those out at myspace.com/chillpackhollywood.
Right. And in fact, one of those honorable mentions, I actually after you posted, I actually then put it on my top 10 list as number 10. I know.
But you criticized all of them so heavily.
Not heavily. Was it
pretty heavily? I mean, like, I was trying to figure out. So Alice in Wonderland, everything about it you hated. And yet it's one of the four honorable mentions you had.
It looked spectacular.
Quite, did it? Okay.
I thought it looked good. I liked the art direction.
That's honorable mention.
Well, that's how bad the movies were this year.
I have like seven Best Picture nominees on my honorable mention.
Really?
List. Yeah.
So, and then where's, so I can't wait to hear your top 10.
Yeah.
This is going to be exciting.
I am very excited about this year's top 10 because, no, the marker for me of it being such a weak year was that I had a very hard time coming up with what was going to be on the top 10. I had no trouble getting 20.
Ah, right.
But then narrowing it to 10 was very problematic because I had five that absolutely belonged on a top 10.
Right.
And then 10, 11, 12 that were all worthy of a second 10.
Right.
And so it's interesting. But one of the things when I put these together, I find increasingly each year I like to... have a nice variety represented.
You watch
these
some
are not
films?
Necessarily my 10 favorite,
mm-hmm.
Although they could be. But certainly in terms of how I view movies, I do try to constantly open myself up to different. I liked to see a documentary today. I'll see a foreign film tomorrow. I'll see an action film the next day. A comedy the next.
Keep it always moving.
Yeah. And expose myself to as wide a range as possible. Not only for me.
Yeah.
But for our loyal listeners.
That's why you do it.
Because I care about them. So it is a very versatile, flexible, light on its feet list.
Oh, see? Much like...
Tap dancing its way into people's hearts.
Your ninja list of 10.
And you know what keeps my list running fast and
oh,
keeps
tell me.
It cool?
What could that be?
The chill pack.
Oh, yeah.
I put a chill pack under my laptop before we started.
So did I.
And because I knew that the action was going to come fast and furious, hot and heavy on today's show.
Hot. Keyword.
And so very important that we keep our laptops running fast, keep them running efficiently by keeping them cool. You can do the same through using a chill pack.
Mm-hmm.
It's environmentally friendly, it's easy to use, and it's incredibly affordable. Check it out at chillpack.com, chillpack.com.
So easy.
All right.
So how are we going to do this? Are we going to start with number one and go down to 10, or are we just going to jump
No, we always off? We go 10 to 1.
I know, but we always miss...
No, okay, don't say we.
okay.
No, I actually have numbers in front of mine.
Oh, you
everything.
Do?
I guess the two caveats that I would like to give is that last year I did not include The White Ribbon, Michael Haneke's film, which ended up being nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. And, you know, I had a sneaking suspicion when we did our Best of the Decade list that it could make my Best of the Decade without even having seen it. And sure enough, it probably would have. It certainly would have been number one on my list last year. But I don't feel comfortable including it this year because it opened on... the 30th of December, 2009. So I did not include it because it's not a 2010 film. And I generally do, I really do, at a time when release dates seem to matter less and less because people will see films so many different ways, I do try to restrict it to what's the year it's first released in this country.
Well, see, now there's
no matter release, when it was made.
Limit release, and then there's also film festival release. So, I mean... For me, should we start? Because I have the Swedish
film.
That was just my
caveat.
Okay.
And then the
pretty
only
particular.
One that I did not see this year,
yeah.
so that we can look forward to my caveat next year when I finally caught up with it, a film that I think everyone who saw it had it number one on their list, and that's the 5.5-hour Carlos.
Oh, yeah.
About Carlos the Jackal. And it's playing in miniseries form on Sundance right now. But it, of course, was released theatrically here last year. And I've yet to catch up with it.
Because you got to take 5.5 hours out of your life.
I saw the first 2.5 hours, and it's fantastic. And
really?
I thought about including part one on my list, but that that would be something you would do. So I decided against that. All right, why don't you get started with number 10?
My number 10 is actually the Angelina Jolie film, which was my honorable mention. So I told you I switched this out, and that's Salt. I totally, yeah, I know. Yeah, there was no third act on it, as we said, but Angelina Jolie is a Russian, perhaps mole or Manchurian candidate, and action-packed. I loved it, and I'd watch it again.
Great.
I'm saying I love Salt.
Excellent.
Why is that wrong? You know, all women should be action stars from here on in, because it makes sense that you can jump off a bridge.
I think you want to reverse that.
All action stars should be women.
Yeah.
Yeah, not all women should be action stars.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. All action stars
Kathy Bates.
Absolutely. Why not? Why not, I say? As funny as that sounds, I think she would be an awesome.
It didn't work so well with Whoopi Goldberg. Remember when they tried to turn her into an action star?
Yeah.
In fact, I remember she did a movie where she played a cop and a T-Rex was her partner, and it was the most expensive film ever to premiere on the TNT network because it didn't get theatrical or home video.
I don't remember this.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, a buddy cop movie with a T-Rex and Whoopi Goldberg, and the T-Rex was more believable.
Well, you can't listen. That,
but anyway, but the point was no. I just I'm not disagreeing with your point. I was just correcting you in the grammar of it.
In the sequence of it. Okay, fine. Okay, well that's my take.
Yeah, I don't want to see Sissy Spacek as an action star.
I think that'd be awesome.
Okay.
Yeah, a little frail girl, just guns. I mean, it's like Helen Mirren in Red.
Right.
She had the that was awesome, wasn't it?
Okay.
Well.
Yeah. Fine. Right.
So, forget it.
No.
This whole show's over.
Number 10?
For you.
For you was Salt.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're number 10.
I have no number 10.
Ah.
I have a two-way tie for 9th. And in years past, I've cheated by making two-way ties for 10th.
Right.
But I decided not to cheat. And the reason that I have a two-way tie, even though I think one of these films is probably, from a filmmaking standpoint, superior to the other, I find them to be such... bookends on a particular topic that really, if you watch them both, you get a very holistic view on this subject matter.
Right.
And that was fascinating for me. And it's the Wall Street collapse, the banking conspiracy that has taken over this country for the last 30 years and the world.
And the world.
Inside Job, directed by Charles Ferguson, narrated by Matt Damon. Fantastic film. I mean, just a really interesting movie,
right?
You know, and the other one is Client 9: The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer.
Wow,
the sheriff of Wall Street,
right?
And
he's in the Inside Job, giving a lot of interviews about how he was trying to. Isn't he in?
I don't think he's in Inside Job.
Oh, no. I thought I saw a clip of him talking about.
I think you saw a clip from Client 9 talking about it.
Really,
because it has to take on. In order to tell the story of Elliot Spitzer and his rise and fall, it has to tell the story of Wall Street as well. But whereas Inside Job tries to make it less about personalities and less about specific people and targets, Client 9 is, of course, especially about the specific people and the players.
Mm.
And it's fascinating. It's really fascinating about the... You know, the type of character that rises to success in that world and the kind of character it takes to rise to success in trying to police that world. It's really, really interesting and really dark and fascinating. And both are what I like about both Charles Ferguson and Alex Gibney, who made Client 9, is that neither of them forget... amidst all their information, their wealth of information, and no doubt, especially on the part of Charles Ferguson, his intent, his clear intent going into the film in terms of what he wanted to convey, neither lose sight of the fact that they also, by the way, are making a movie.
Right.
And it should work as a movie.
Right. That you have the structure and story and...
So two documentaries start off my list.
Look at that.
Inside Job by Charles Ferguson and Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer. Inside Job, of course, is nominated for Best Documentary.
Right. So that would put maybe that at 9 and then the other one at Elliot Spitzer 10.
9B, maybe.
9B. Right. So that's awesome. So my number 9 is also a documentary, Joan Rivers' Piece of Work.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah. This is a documentary of her... life as it is today with her. You follow her around for an entire year, and she actually performs at a club in Wisconsin, a casino that I performed at as well, with Skippy, Mark Price. Him and I went up there. So it was hilarious how much I could relate to this, and also how much I couldn't relate to it. Her need to have every day filled on her calendar, like all of that, and how you know, she talks openly about her husband committing suicide after the Fox talk show ended very badly, right, and all of this stuff, and how her and her daughter Melissa actually healed by doing a TV movie of the week about the suicide of their father slash husband. And yeah, it's like, wow, there's so many things wrong with this. And yet at the same time, here she is fighting. She's 75 years old. She still is funny. And it was really quite an amazing documentary. And the amount of access she gives to the camera crew is remarkable as well. So I was both shocked and quite pleased by that movie.
It's a good movie.
Yeah. So there you go.
Number eight for me.
Oh.
An independent film.
What?
And a film that I saw this past summer. And as I mentioned when I saw it, I'm so gratified that I hadn't seen the trailers or the marketing campaign before seeing it. Because if I had, I don't know if I would have enjoyed it
right,
as much, because I feel it was not marketed as what it was.
Our classic bugaboo. How marketing screws up a good independent movie.
But, you know, I love movies where the locale is not just important to the film, which is very hard in American movies, because yes, our relationship to space, to location, is so different than
anywhere
that
else.
Relationship for people anywhere else in the world.
Right.
And but not only where it's important, and your story really needed to be set there, but also when that location becomes a character in
yes,
and of itself. And a film that did that wonderfully for me is Winter's Bone.
Mm.
And this is a mystery and a suspense and a thriller, and really such a, oh, just an appallingly realistic depiction to me of the economic realities for certain people. I mean, it kind of reminded me a couple years ago when we both had like Frozen River
on our
list.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the ability to put these suspense mystery stories in a milieu that reveals a part of actual American society that most people aren't seeing. I think that that's why, you know, getting back to a couple years back, Eastwood's Gran Torino resonated so much around the country,
right,
even though it didn't so much in this city.
Right.
It didn't get award nominations, but it got a huge box office. And it wasn't just because Clint's cool. We know Clint's cool.
Yeah, right.
But the fact that, boy, that was not a character or a story or a locale that anyone else was showing, but it's a character, a story, and a locale that matters
everybody
to people.
Everybody can relate to. That's
and,
right.
And Winter's Bone, you know, to a lesser degree, a much more marginalized slice of this society.
And this is the Appalachian Mountains, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the film is carried by newcomer Jennifer Lawrence, Oscar-nominated performance.
Look at that.
One of these performances where when you see this indie film, you hope that enough people see it, because if enough people see it, you know she's got to get a nomination.
Right.
Much like, again, Melissa Leo in Frozen River.
Yeah, yeah.
You just know that what you're seeing is really, if enough people see it, it's a no-brainer. But
right,
the question is, will enough people see it?
Exactly.
And with a wonderful supporting turn by just, is there a more solid go-to supporting player than John Hawks? You know, from Deadwood and
yeah,
Me, You, and Everyone We Know, and Eastbound and Down, the television series.
Oh, right.
You know, and he, a very famous X-Files episode, too, where he plays the writer who becomes obsessed with Scully.
Oh, that's right. That's yeah, John Hawks.
That's John Hawks.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, and he's Oscar-nominated for Winter's Bone.
Look
as
at
well.
Him. Well, good for him. I haven't seen it because I saw the trailers and I thought, oh, this is rather.
Turn off your phone.
Turn off the
because
phone.
Because everybody heard that call
no,
through
they
static long before it came
no,
in. I guarantee it.
It was way over here. Okay, bastard. I'm turning off my phone. Everybody, turn off your phone before.
So that was number eight for me. I think we're on to number eight for you.
My number eight is, Oh, where is it? Oh, True Grit. Yeah, did you see that? This is the Coen Brothers.
You shouldn't ask me when you've seen my honorable mention list.
Oh, right. Right. I didn't see your honorable mention list. I thought it was great up until the last 10 minutes. And then it was like a different movie all of a sudden. You know, and then, I mean, the characters were rich, the location, it was detailed. I loved it as a Western. The young girl, spectacular, absolutely spectacular. And then...
So what changes in the last 10 minutes?
Suddenly they just jam like a bunch of action in that just seemed completely irrelevant to everything else.
And almost make him, the Jeff Bridges character, the main character.
Yeah.
Like, because the climax takes place not through the point of view of the girl.
Right. She's
even though she's carried the whole film and she's narrating it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it does become a different film. Once you shift that perspective, I think it isn't surprising that it becomes a different...
And to me, it was awful. It was like, well, there's all these loose ends, these, you know, emotionally you're left hanging, and do you even...
Which is okay, traditionally, in a Coen Brothers film especially, but not in a film then when you're going to play the traditional ending.
Yeah, I know, and then that ending tacked on like that is just like, what?
I've said before, and I wrote about this in the blog, that I found it to be lesser Coen Brothers. You know, the best of their lesser films.
Yeah.
Not one that they deeply cared about, like No Country for Old Men or A Serious Man. But the best of their lesser efforts. I do think, though, that there are other times when the film kind of loses it. And I say that because I was losing it.
Mm.
When we first meet the Jeff Bridges character in that courtroom.
Yeah.
I realized about 5 minutes into that scene that I hadn't been paying any attention to that scene. And I talked to other people in the screening that day, and they said, what was it about that scene that none of us were couldn't pay attention? And only when the camera pushed in on Jeff Bridges did we, like, make the effort to now be paying attention.
Right, take a look at the guy. Huh, that's true, isn't it? Yeah. So,
but when we were sharing the perspective, you know, really on that girl,
yeah,
the movie's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I thought she could carry that whole thing herself, and well,
I love that she's nominated for supporting actress.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though she's the main character,
she's the main character. The this whole thing of lesser Coen Brothers, do they really just phone it in, or are they? Is it when you slack one off that you then get lazy all across the board? Like, you know,
I don't think they did. I mean, clearly they were doing some wonderful. It was their most accessible movie that they've ever done. Clearly.
True.
I just think that there's sometimes where they're not. Look, The Lady Killers, the remake of The Lady Killers, or Intolerable Cruelty, or, you know, I think there are times when they're not delving to come up with this stuff.
Right.
That doesn't mean I don't think that they're not applying great integrity to the making of the film. I just think that sometimes, you know, Burn After Reading.
Yeah.
You know, hey, wouldn't it be fun if we just did, you know, like, here's the story idea.
What if Brad Pitt,
be fun?
Yeah,
John Malkovich. As opposed to A Serious Man, which, you know, there was no, hey, wouldn't it be fun if we did this? No, that had to be a very detailed, complex conversation of what if we focused on a guy who, and then, and they were bringing out a lot of personal material.
Right. So. Well, okay.
All right, anyway, so you're number eight, that's True Grit, nominated for Best Picture, and I think 10 Oscar nominations altogether.
Well, that was a good Rooster Cogburn, for sure.
Rooster Cogburn.
Cogburn, yeah.
And, oh, by the way, how about Matt Damon? Again, this is the second time Matt Damon's being mentioned in this show.
Yeah.
But, you know, when there were some people who criticized the movie as soon as it came out because, you know, they compared it to the original. And the Oscar-winning original. And but the thing about it, for all those people who say, oh, they should never remake the original True Grit, I have two words for all of you. Glenn Campbell.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, did you realize while watching it that Matt Damon was playing the same character as Glenn Campbell?
I did not. No, not even.
You have to, like, really go, oh, that's who Glenn Campbell was supposed to be?
No.
Now it makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
But
yeah.
Matt Damon actually played the guy from the book. It was very cool.
Poor Glenn Campbell. That guy, you know, never mind.
And I love that Matt Damon, you know, just he does not really seem to have any vanity at all.
Yeah.
Like, you really know, get wrapped up in as a leading man. I mean, you know, compare that with The Informant, and you know,
yeah.
I mean, he's so willing to be, to what about become him, a borderline buffoon.
Him and Sarah Silverman and the fucking Matt Damon song. Did you see that one? Did you not see Sarah Silverman?
I thought it was Ben
and
Affleck.
No, Ben Affleck and Jimmy Kimmel did it afterwards. After I Sarah's see. Thing came a huge hit.
And that Sarah Silverman video is number what on your
list? It should be number one. Now that I think about it, if I could put just short YouTube videos on my list of top movies.
That'll be next week's theme show. And I'll do the 10 worst. Number seven for me, a film that really incredibly overlooked by everyone except the Writers Guild that gave it a special award, which I thought was very, very interesting.
That's very
and
interesting.
And it's the story about the outing of Valerie Plame as a CIA
asset. Oh, yeah.
Naomi Watts in a fantastic performance. I think her best performance.
Really?
The most riveting thriller that I've seen in many, many years. But by Doug Liman, who makes darn Cummings. Good thrillers. I mean, yeah. When you think Go, you think The Firstborn Identity.
Yeah.
Makes really interesting films. He also makes enemies. Not just with the films, but with how he makes the movies. And I think that's part of the problem is Sean Penn gives a really good performance as Ambassador Joe Wilson. I think superior to some of his award-winning work, but he would not promote the film. He instead went on a promotional tour promoting Javier Bardem's work in Beautiful, but would not promote his own film because of how little he got along with Doug Liman, the director.
Wow.
And so I don't think the film really stood much of a chance.
That's why,
at that point.
Because I remember seeing the trailer going, I really want to see this, and then I couldn't find it anywhere. I couldn't find a plan. Where did you actually end up seeing it? That's what even more amazing.
I saw it at the Directors Guild before it came out.
Look at you. That's all you get.
Anyway, so much fun, so exciting, so thrilling as a spy thriller. It's the best spy thriller. I mean, you have Salt on your list. You talk about you want women to be action stars.
Yep.
Well, see, fair game.
Wow.
I mean, here it's Naomi Watts, a very believable action star, who, unlike Angelina Jolie, does not ever lose her vulnerability while playing an action star. And playing a real-life action star.
Is there... Well, that's what I thought. I thought it would sort of be a political tome more than any action in it, really. I mean, as a CIA operative, she was already back in America when she was out it, so there was not...
I think... I don't know if she was back. No, they were in the middle of an operation.
Oh.
Yeah. And, what happens to her contacts and to that operation? It's heartbreaking.
Oh.
Yeah.
And it's all true?
It's based on their books.
Oh, okay.
On their accounts. I mean, you know.
Okay, well, now it's on my...
Karl Rove, and certainly Scooter Libby, who was the only person to go to jail for it, right. He would claim that it wasn't all true. I'm sure Dick Cheney would claim that it wasn't all true.
I see.
But we do know for a fact that a CIA operative was outed illegally.
Right.
In violation of the Patriot Act that they authored.
and
it's an offense that's supposed to be punishable by death.
Wow. And Scooter only doing time.
Yeah. Stopped way over there.
Wow.
But such a fun film. I mean, that's the thing. Exactly. I mean, how do you market this? Because it does seem like it's going to be, it could be a political tome, but we live in this, you know, we've talked about, you know, why conspiracy films can't do well,
right.
Why fictional conspiracy films can't do well, and why, you know, but something like this, it seems like it's going to be a political film, but I mean, it is a real life spy thriller.
Yeah.
And, as, you know, a result, it's far more interesting than anything anybody's going to concoct.
Wow. Yeah, it's true.
Because the real life actually is more interesting than R-E-E-L, life. All right. Number six for you. Or seven. I'm sorry.
Seven.
Number seven.
My seven is...
Look at me trying to screw you up.
Yeah, look you. We already talked about it. Helen Mirren. It's all your big aging action stars. Bruce Willis in Red. Red is the... We talked about this film when we both saw it. We both loved it, and it was lots of laughs, great cast.
Dave Soboloff right now is turning over in his grave, and he's alive. Dave Soboloff is very much alive. I don't want to imply that he isn't, but I believe he's digging a grave, he's getting into it, and he's rolling over in it, because, of course, he went to see this at our recommendation and really, really had a bone to pick with us.
Yes, he certainly did, and so yeah. That's why I put it on my top 10, just for you, David, just because...
But I did bring up that time that I find it interesting that you enjoy it so much because of this issue that I enjoy. I enjoyed it, and one of the things that I enjoyed about it so much was all the stunt casting.
Right.
That I was very aware that every time the film started to lose momentum, it's almost like they knew the film was going to lose momentum, so let's get another stunt casting
right.
thing.
Get Ernest Borgnine in there.
Or Morgan Freeman, or whoever it turns up, right?
Yeah.
And that would then propel it forward for a few more scenes.
Yeah.
And they kept doing this. And why I find it interesting, though, that you like that is that you hate any idea that you are being stunt casted in some way.
Yeah. So isn't that ironic? You love that which you hate? I mean, it's a, you know, you're the psychologist.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm not saying that it is hypocritical. I'm just saying it is interesting. I mean, look, there's... People were surprised when I made, you know, Karl Rove, I Love You, and my response to it was, you know, it was really fun making a movie that I would want to see.
Yeah.
And people said, well, shouldn't you always be doing that? No, you tell the stories that you have to tell. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's what you want to go
Much like
see.
Stand-up comics, often they'll do jokes that they themselves don't really find funny or laugh at, but get huge laughs from the audience. And I know four or five comics whose act is completely different than their sense of humor. So the case in point.
That's interesting. And I would think that the ones who are really become or maybe branch out or who are thought of as great writers, that they might be contrary to that, that they might really
Delve
be honing
in.
Their writing through the performance rather
right.
than, hey, what works? No, this is what I want to explore.
Right, which is very different. And then you go off on a tangent because often what you explore isn't funny to everyone else. Norm Macdonald being a perfect example of that. He clears 3 out of 5 rooms he performs in because when he's exploring something very personal that he finds funny, he'll start giggling if no one's laughing because his job is to make people laugh, and the irony of what he thinks is funny isn't making everyone laugh.
Right.
Then he starts giggling, and then everybody just thinks he's lost it, and they leave the club.
How about this for a segue? Okay. To number 6 on my list, very much about performance, about comedy, and about sticking true to what you do, regardless of the changing times and the changing tastes, and really the changing attention spans. This is a film that's about all of that, even though it's set in 1959, the year that it was written.
By
Jacques Tati.
My favorite French comedian.
The first film that I ever, I think I saw in any film class in the ivory tower of cultural elitism, that is the public university UCLA, was Mon Oncle.
Mon Oncle.
By Jacques Tati. Yeah. And, of course, he was a wonderful comedic director and actor.
And a precursor to Mr. Bean and,
Monsieur Hulot. But also, I thought am I wrong in thinking that he was also very much the heir to the Chaplin and the Keaton?
Because continuation. It was almost silent.
Almost silent, and his films really knew no language boundary.
And that's why they could do very well here in the U.S. They didn't know.
So an animated adaptation from the director of The Triplets of Belleville manages to be the best animated film of the year. It manages to be... one of the best foreign language films of the year. Mm-hmm. It also manages to be really a silent film. And that's The Illusionist from Sylvain Chomet. And this is such a funny, charming, heartwarming, and heartbreaking film.
Right. I'm dying to see it. I haven't seen it yet, but it's on my list.
Nominated for the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature.
Wow. And won, I believe, the Annie.
No, it did not.
What? Which did? How to Train Your Dragon.
How to Train Your Dragon.
Mad bastards.
Yeah.
That's always the way it is. But which was also a good movie.
I guess.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, I saw that.
You didn't like it?
It's not anywhere near my honorable mention list.
Okay, moving on then. What number are we at? 6?
6 for you, yeah.
6 for me is Kick-Ass. Oh, my God, I love this. Nick Cage doing Adam West, a family of regular people being superheroes. The little girl's awesome. The soundtrack's spectacular. I thought it was great. I thought it was funny. I love that movie. I'm just saying, Kick-Ass.
People, there are people who absolutely love this film. And then there are people like myself who don't think that it works in any way.
What?
But that's okay. I mean, I think that that's, as opposed to a Scott Pilgrim,
yes,
which you had on your runner-up, which I think we all could kind of agree on was like, oh, God, that almost. They almost.
They're so close.
They almost. God, I wanted them to, you know. Yeah, really, but wouldn't you, now, and given the fact that they both underperformed, you know, below expectations so much, as a filmmaker, wouldn't you rather have the case where some people just swear by it and some people say, that didn't work at all?
Yeah.
And my experience with the with Kick-Ass was that I found the first half,
yeah,
interesting,
yeah,
but I couldn't see the director's personality at all. And I'm a fan of the director, Matthew Vaughn, who'd done Layer Cake.
Right.
And I thought I couldn't see his personality at all. And the film's working.
Right.
Then in the second half, his personality takes over, and I found that the film stopped working.
Interesting.
And, you know, and that's the thing that's just, you know, what makes all this, of course, so subjective. But it's, and again, when it comes to sort of expectation and to the relationship we have with the filmmakers or with the actors, and, you know, we all bring our own perspective into it.
Right.
And it isn't even necessarily about, like, what we're inclined to like or dislike. There is no way to clear your mind of expectation, nor should there be, because right, also often bringing
some
these past
things,
histories of, you know, especially interesting filmmakers, bringing that past history to bear on what you're watching, as I'll talk about in a moment, can really help enliven something you're seeing and add rich layers to it.
Wow, that's right.
Because for many filmmakers, it's almost like you're reading another chapter of a great novel.
Yeah.
When you see their new film.
Right.
I that's got to be the experience that you have, like watching Chaplin.
Absolutely.
Or whatever,
yeah. You don't just watch one film. And go, oh, that's the film.
Stand
you,
alone.
Yes. Yeah. You see his entire body of work, and you just go, oh my gosh, that's incredible. So.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
Number six, Kick-Ass.
Yep.
So number five for me, really, to me, the film that saved summer and kind of validated studio filmmaking in general.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it had to be made by someone who operates with almost complete independence and autonomy. The director is Christopher Nolan. The film is Inception.
Ah, yes.
And, you know, more than being a great film, because I'm not sure if it is a great film.
Hmm.
I know that it is a greatly rewarding and enjoyable film. It just embodies so much of what I grew up loving about film.
Right.
You know, the idea, the audacious idea of how we play with time and compression of time.
Yeah.
You know, and in this case, the dreams within dreams. But every film is a dream within dreams.
Yeah, exactly.
And, but also, you know, I was thinking about this. Inception as a modern day Casablanca.
Ah.
Casablanca, not a film about lost love, but a film about regained idealism.
Right.
Right? That,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
what
that's
made
what
it so romantic.
Exactly. That he came out from his stupor.
Now, people will debate back and forth, and we won't even talk about the ending of Inception, but people will debate what it meant, blah, 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 blah. But it is about regained idealism. It is about regaining a piece of himself.
Hmm.
The main character self.
Yeah, I guess so.
Also, how about this... You know, the yes, Casablanca had an actual city name as part of it, but it really was not a place that existed anywhere other than our collective dreams.
Right, exactly.
And this wonderful international cast with all these different looks and all these different accents, probably no accent truly specific to the country of origin where they supposedly derive.
Right, exactly. They're all off slightly.
But it was fine because it was just this wonderful international mixture of great character actors. And again, Inception has that.
Yeah.
It's this wonderful international cast of great actors all being given interesting things to do,
yeah,
a true ensemble. And so I find it as much about film and our love of filmmaking and why we love movies,
yeah,
as I do about how dreams work.
Right.
I feel it's as much about how the dreams of movies work as it is about the dreams of themselves. Of dreams.
Yeah. Absolutely. And in terms of everybody working together, I mean, the acting's great, the directing's great, and even the CGI is at one of the few times where the CGI is mind-boggling, yet it's enhancing the story.
Yes.
Right? As opposed to just having crazy CGI that then the actors seem to be lost in some green screen studio, not being able to relate to what's going on. That all of that is like an emotional resonance of what the characters are going through.
There's something kind of rewarding too when you're dealing with filmmakers who will say to you basically, if you suspend your disbelief at the outset, we won't ask you to suspend your disbelief again.
Right. Just once. Just go with us on this ride.
As opposed to, you know, I was watching the original Ghostbusters this weekend, right? And remember how great that looked when that came out.
Yeah, right.
And now it's like, boy, I see the traveling mats.
Oh, yeah, totally. With the
dog.
The dog chasing Rick Moranis.
You know, and I have to now suspend it again.
Yeah, I know.
And yet, as they all said in the documentary, the on location at the time, and the reason why Ghostbusters was such a big deal was they tried really to make a movie that you could believe could happen.
Right.
As opposed to saying, we're going to make a comedy. No, we want to play as real as this can be.
Which is what you want to do in comedies anyway. Play the reality.
Good point.
See? Huh? Look what
I
did there.
So number five for you.
Number five, believe it or not, not any on anybody's list in the top tens, but...
I believe it.
Oh.
You haven't exactly really hit anything that's been on any... Well, they've been on your top 10 list. Okay, number five.
Anyway, it's Exit 2... Or no, Despicable Me. Steve Carell does a great Russian accent.
And a spoiler alert was involved there, too, I bet. Okay, anyway, Despicable Me. A lot of people loved this.
Yeah, it was cute, adorable. The story was, you know, they didn't go out of their way to be, oh, this has to be more extreme. It has to have attitude or anything like that. It was a perfectly told story, adorably told, and I thought it was...
So why did... I saw this. Yeah. Why did this film... get forgotten amidst... I mean, I understand with The Illusionist, but why did it get forgotten with, like, How to Train Your Dragon?
And Toy Story 3. I mean, these things, I think...
Is it that Megamind, although everybody said Megamind was kind of a poor person's Despicable Me, but is it the fact that Megamind came so close on the heels of it that it kind of watered down...
It could very well be.
Cause, people's memories? Because Despicable Me got great reviews and great box office.
That's true. But then Megamind came in, and then it was, oh, dear Lord. Yeah.
And the heart in Despicable Me.
Yeah.
I mean, so I would think adorable. That here's a film, as opposed to, I mean, I enjoyed Megamind. I thought it was funny. Despicable Me, here's a film that, again, I would think that you could sit and watch with your kids.
Yeah.
And that they would love it, and you'll love it just as much.
Yeah.
And then speaks to all ages without speaking down to any of them, which, again, kind of is sort of old Hollywood.
Yeah, kind of is. And sort of, well... I would say Toy Story 3 does that too, but not as much because it seems very geared, that one, to older man boys and letting go, you know?
Or at least to your, at the very least, your affection towards that series.
Right.
And those past films.
Right. Yeah.
And I had limited affection towards those, so therefore Toy Story 3 didn't really do anything for me.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all about whether, I would find myself watching it going, oh, that's clever.
Yes, exactly.
As opposed to Despicable Me, which is even when the idea wasn't clever or I didn't find something funny, it's like, I really like the story of these three little girls.
Yeah.
And the
guy and the thing. There you go. Okay, right. What's your number?
Number four. And four. Speaking again about approaching films and realizing that sometimes, these are chapters of a book. Danny Boyle.
Right.
Oscar-winning filmmaker for Slumdog Millionaire, who has made many notable films, some very successful films.
Trainspotting.
28 Days Later.
Oh, yeah.
I realized while watching 127 Hours, makes the same film again and again and again, as so many of us do.
Right.
This is not a criticism.
Ah.
I just realized how each one of his films is the same. And specifically, the theme that he keeps revisiting is this very human truism that either we will seek out that which will reveal to us what we are made of, or it will seek us out.
Wow.
There is a moment. This is the story of the extreme hiker who gets trapped by a boulder while hiking in the desert and is trapped and stranded alone with no hope for survival. And he says at one point, this character, this boulder has been looking for me, has been waiting for me all my life. And all of Danny Boyle's movies are this way, that we all have the boulder oh that's waiting for us and looking for us if we don't seek out the boulder. That we all will have to come face to face with literally what we are made of.
Right.
And this metaphor is expressed in quite graphic visual terms, reducing this character to what he is made of, emotionally and physically.
And physically.
And spiritually and psychologically as well. You see all of this. He is stripped down to this. And when I realized that all of Danny Boyle's films are about this, I thought, well, first of all, what could be more redemptive, a theme to right. keep revisiting. It gave me greater appreciation for some of his films that I hadn't, that I don't think work so much.
Right.
But again, we've talked about this before, that when we, you know, to be very careful about criticizing a specific film, because realize, again, with storytellers, that the film that you did not like might be responsible for a film that you did like later on.
Right.
Because they were working through something.
You had to go through that hell to make that.
As we know it, just from a technical challenge standpoint, sometimes you have to learn things so that then you have the answer later on down the right. road of how to make it work. There are no failures. There's simply a learning process.
Learning process. And that learning process has to be in front of a public audience, unfortunately.
The other thing that Danny Boyle does in this, and I felt so relieved to have the train spotting Danny Boyle back.
Right.
Was that he is a master when he finds the right story to allow for this skill. He is a master at creating in the audience a visceral sense of what the character on screen is going through.
Right.
Think of Trainspotting. I mean, I want to convey to an audience what this heroin addicted and withdrawal lifestyle is like. How right. do I let an audience actually know
right.
this and give them a visceral feeling of it rather than an intellectual,
or try to tell or have the, you know, the character
or just
say it,
create sympathy or yes. any of this. And how do I let the audience know what it's like to be in this circumstance? Some have argued that he did that with Slumdog Millionaire, but he didn't need to for Slumdog Millionaire. We right. see the slums, we already have a visceral
right.
reaction.
We know it.
To it. But these other circumstances are so foreign to so many of our experiences.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so it is a breathtaking job of direction, and really one of the most illuminating and really uplifting films I saw. It is hard to watch. I mean, I would never recommend wow. anyone watch it, because it is really hard. It is brutal. But once I realized in that third act, oh, you know, a light switch came on. This is his theme. This right. is the theme that interests Danny Boyle. I started weeping uncontrollably. I was weeping for the character, and I was weeping in gratitude that there is a storyteller who deals with this theme again
right.
and again.
Awesome. And that's so interesting, because I think you had no interest in seeing this thing at all.
Well, it hit too close to home.
Is that what it was?
Because as you know, I hate when I go extreme hiking and a boulder falls on me and I have to cut off my arm.
All the time. I know.
Next week, when I tell the story about thinking I'm younger than I am.
Can't wait.
And being old enough to know better, you'll understand why if I'd starred in the movie, it couldn't have been called 127 hours. It might have been called, you know, 14 minutes. Because I don't have a lot of patience.
A lot of patience. Things. Just cut my arm now. That's so. It. Awesome. Okay. Number three.
Number four for you.
My number four. Oh, yes, right. The Swedish film, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. This is based on, of course, the...
Now, you liked this movie less than I did.
Yes.
You were underwhelmed by it. You said there was nothing wrong with it,
right.
but you expected way too much from it.
I did. And, then
now it's number four.
Well, because I looked at it again. And I thought, oh, I should give it a fair shake. Because you go in with expectations. As you said, you go into films with expectations, like you did with 127 Hours, and you come out differently. And so I went in with expectations and was slightly underwhelmed. But now I realize that it's, compared to a lot of the crap I saw this year, a pretty good film.
Number four, compared to the crap I saw, a pretty good film.
Yeah. You know, nice. Well, this is what happens when you see a lot of crap movies. You water down.
Oh, look, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the best of the trilogy, obviously. Her performance is fantastic. I think the lead actor is great.
Yeah.
And again, I got a sense of locale.
Yes.
In that. Yeah,
and I was in Stockholm in April and totally resonated how awesome my family's hometown is. My family's hometown.
Well, number three for me is a foreign language film.
It is.
And also kind of a thriller and a suspense
film.
It was the Oscar winner last year for Best Foreign Language Film.
Well, then technically it would be last year's film.
But it did not open anywhere in the U.S. Until the 16th of April, 2010, after it won the Oscar.
I see.
Right. It was because the countries don't need to submit them through a release. They just submit them as their entry.
Right. They send a DVD over the thing. And that movie is called?
The Secret in Their Eyes from Argentina, from director Juan José Campanella. This is a fantastic movie that deals with compression of time as well.
Ooh.
And it's about a court investigator. It's set really in the courts in Argentina, which is a different judicial system than we have here.
Right.
And it is a judicial investigator, one of the counselors who investigates cases for the judge, independent from the police.
Oh.
And there is a case that goes unsolved for a long time, finally gets solved, but quite unhappily so, and it haunts this man throughout his life. And at the beginning of the film, we see him, older life, retired for much time, writing a memoir and wanting to go back and revisit that case. And we constantly are shifting back and forth between different time periods. And it's really about a film about unconditional love and the timelessness of unconditional love, while at the same time being a mystery and a revenge film and a suspense film, and because of its location, its setting, and its time, you know, an entirely different world for me, which is when foreign language films are so much fun.
So it deserved the Oscar.
Oh, over White Ribbon, probably not. It was more. It was a friendlier movie for audiences than The White Ribbon.
I see.
Though very similar in some ways.
How bizarre. Wow. Okay. That
probably
was
the most fun film that I have on my list this year.
You don't have a fun film. You didn't have fun this year.
I have some fun films on here, but that was kind of my most fun because I love mysteries and thrillers and suspense. Okay. So number three on your list
is The King's Speech. This is, as we know, the next nominated Oscar film. It's told from Queen Elizabeth's dad's horrible stutter that he had, and the speech therapist who helps him give a speech, not just one speech, but all the speeches.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, like, come on. I know, it's so sensitive.
That's the title. That's the title of the film. No, it's kind of... Go ahead, yeah.
Oh, no. You're right, spoiler alert. I'm not going to say anything else about it. Does he say the speech? I don't know. Does he get through it?
It's going to win Best Picture.
You think?
Probably going to win Best Actor.
Yes. Even though you now ruined it for me, suggesting that he actually overcame a stutter in real life.
You see Colin Firth in earlier film roles, and his stutter is very much his stock in trade.
Ah, I did not realize.
Does that make it a less performance? No, but there is a little bit of the acrobat nature of these performances that we do tend to reward, right?
Right. Because, I mean, when Jodie Foster did Nell, did she have a background in mental incapacity? I don't know. I'm stuck there. Anyway, the point is, I liked King's Speech. I went through many of the very same voice elocution classes, and it was a joy to actually see those scenes where they're actually doing voice work.
And might I say that you really helped rally the spirits of Canada during the darkness of World War II.
I certainly did. It's unbelievable how I did that.
Number two for me, an amazing documentary, could very easily be my number one film of the year. I went back and forth on this.
Oh, you did?
Just a thrilling film, funny. Yeah. And insightful and daring. It's about the street art movement that exploded and imploded over this past decade.
Yep.
Banksy's Exit Through the Gift Shop.
My number two as well. How weird is that?
So, now that you've seen it,
yes.
What do you love about it?
I love that the documentary film, the way it turns on him, that to me was so unique. I hadn't seen that anywhere. I sort of love, and plus I love Banksy's artwork. You know, we got a piece, Banksy graffitied right across the street from here, where he, did you know this?
Yeah.
Did you see that thing? Where
what I loved is living in L.A. and living in L.A. for this decade, we got to see so many of these pieces.
Yeah.
And wonder at the time, what's going on there?
Yeah, exactly.
And now I get to find out what was going on.
Right, and see it in reverse. I thought that was fantastic. And of course, you know, I'm glad the street art movement has imploded finally, because it was becoming... I don't know. Should I say pretentious? Would it be too much? Do I cross a line with some of my friends who do street art? I myself have sprayed a wall or two in my day.
It went from art to commerce so fast.
Yeah.
Without being art and commerce for a length of time.
Well, that's what the machine does, though. It picks up any new movement and turns it into an economic
Certainly movement. Now. I mean, any new movement has a shelf life that's very, very short.
Yeah. And so to even find a movement now, like, you know, you wonder what the kids are doing with that. And there's no movements coming up because they're immediately subsumed into some sort of commercial entity.
And so fascinating that, you know, like I made Carl Rove, I Love You, a film that was fictional that we wanted you to believe was nonfiction.
Right.
And that even if you know it's fictional, you'll swear that a bunch of it has to be real. Here's a film that kind of thumbs its nose at you and dares you to believe it's fake.
Right.
Because of who Banksy is and because of the movement itself.
Right, exactly.
And because he certainly won't reveal who he is, even to promote the film. You know, there's part of you all along that wants to know, is this real?
Yeah, true, right?
Right.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And I wish I actually saw it. You know, they actually showed it up at the Los Angeles Theater, the historic Chaplin-owned theater just up the street here at the Los Angeles. And it was, I think, a premiere, or the LA premiere was there, I think. But it showed there for a week, and I really regret not seeing it on a bigger screen, frankly.
Yeah.
Just to see that wall art and that expanse on a giant screen.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll try to find it again.
And, you know, that it's great, you know, that a film about the street art movement, that, you know, this film would ask, even if you know it's real, you want to ask, you know, wait, could this be phony? And because at the end of the day, who cares?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing.
It's not whether it's real or not real. It's what does it mean?
Yeah.
What does it have to say?
Exactly.
And does it say it artfully? Does it say it entertainingly? And it does both in spades.
In spades.
Like the ending of Inception, you know. It's so boring about, to me, the, you know, I have an idea about it, of course, about, you know, what happens at the end.
Spoiler alert.
But, you know, it's far more rich to think, what does it mean? What is it saying? You know, again, about this quest for regaining lost pieces of oneself.
Right, exactly. So, there you have it.
Okay, well, that's number two for both of us.
There you go. And my number one, of course, we already talked about, is Inception.
We just talked about it again.
Again, look at us all talking about it. We can't stop not talking about it. And so that's...
I'm going to spend the next 2 minutes and 20 seconds going through the negatives on that, trying to figure out we can't not stop talking about
stop
it.
Stop not... I cannot not stop talking about it.
All right. Well, my number one, a filmmaker who was well represented on both our top 10 lists with his last film.
Yes.
The Wrestler.
Yes.
Darren Aronofsky.
Very impressive.
Playing at the top of his game.
Mm-hmm.
Oscar nominated for Best Picture and Best Director and Best Cinematography for my old friend Matt LeBatique, his first Oscar nomination. The man who shot my first two films.
What?
And I did six commercials with.
And I didn't know that.
And a career-defining performance by Natalie Portman.
Mm-hmm.
Black Swan, it was not only, to me, the funniest and scariest and sexiest film of the year, it's also kind of an important movie, if we can say that films are ever important.
Mm-hmm.
I had so many friends who would come from it and say, once I got past how silly it was, I really enjoyed it. And I would dig deeper, and it's really interesting how ballet has this relationship now from the audience at large as being kind of this sterile, antiseptic art form that is in a frame and placed behind glass.
Right. And non-living. I mean, that a lot of the traditional choreography is passed down from 17th century France. you know, even the terms plié, mon Dieu, you know, all of these things are French terms.
And yet here is, you know, it's an art form that's being used to embody one of the most earthy fairy tales, mm-hmm. Swan Lake, of all time.
Right.
A story about the danger of the immature feminine not growing into, embodying, and owning a mature sexuality. That when the immature feminine is not allowed to grow into this, does not claim power through mature sexuality, it leads to the frozen feminine.
Ah.
And this is a fairy tale that teaches, as all the fairy tales did, that taught us about, you know, real human bodily truths. And for Darren Aronofsky to breathe life back into what has become this, again, antiseptic kind of porcelain art form for so many people, not something you can touch, that you can claim for your own. And for him to breathe life back into it by telling that body psychologically rich and scary and thrilling and funny and witty story through the point of view of actors, performers who are meant to be dancing,
right?
Swan Lake was brilliant. Was just a masterstroke. It is every bit Polanski's Repulsion, as much as it is the turning point, which people wanted to make it. You know, It was Red Shoes meets Repulsion.
Well, that's pretty...
It's a psychological horror film.
Oh, I was thinking Red Shoe Diaries. No, not that one.
No. Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, Red Shoes.
Right,
you know,
that one.
So psychologically rich and, again, scary film. I mean, I recommend everybody see Red Shoes. I recommend everybody see Repulsion. I mean, these are really fun, scary, sexy movies and funny movies. As any truly scary movie is, really scary movie.
Yeah. Should
it's
have
kind of sexy
fun.
And it's kind of funny.
Yeah, it should always be that. So I see that as your number one. So
that's my number one.
I can guess which way you're going to be going voting on your Oscar poll then.
I never vote for what I want to win.
Oh, that's
I
right.
I vote for what I think will win.
Oh, right.
I separate always, my heart from my head. But last year I didn't, which is why you were able to win.
That's right.
Never again, my friend. Never again.
Oh, the cynical Phil Ernest.
Hey, you can find for at least a week
one more
every episode we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, chillpackhollywood.com, for at least one more week.
Mm-hmm.
So if you come to our website or if you subscribe via iTunes, I suggest you drop us a line at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
So easy.
Because we're concerned that this coming week there might be a little interruption.
But it shouldn't be.
Or people will need to go a different location.
Right.
Or, of course, if you haven't already, check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. We'll, of course, post all the information there for our likers.
Likers.
Is there anything else? Any other sites that I need to?
Well, we follow us on Twitter, of course.
Oh.
I'm Twitter at @dhaglin.
On twitter.com/phillairness.
It's so easy. And we keep you posting on when these shows go up. So it's fun that way. Until then, I'm Dean Haglund.
I'm Phil Lernis. See you next week.
You bet. Bye-bye.